Blog Talk Radio. Today is Monday, July 13th. I'm Cindy Wolf Boynton, and this is the Literary New England Radio Show. Tonight we feature four novels, a memoir, and we're going to have giveaways of all four of these terrific books. So stay here, please, as I talk with Massachusetts native Paul Tremblay about A Head Full of Ghosts, Tracy Slater, who lives in both Japan and Boston, about The Good Shufu, Finding Love, Self, and Home on the Far Side of the World. I also talk with Jennifer Zun on Mayumi and the Sea of Happiness, which is set in Martha's Vineyard, where Jennifer also lives, and Erica Swiler on The Book of Speculation, a debut novel set along Long Island Sound, which I can actually see from the Literary New England studio in Connecticut. When I say it's time, tweet or email me to win the title of your choice, starting with A Head Full of Ghosts. A Head Full of Ghosts is a novel of drama, suspense, and horror that focuses on the events surrounding the 14-year-old daughter of a suburban New England family who may be mentally ill or may be possessed by the devil. It's a rich, layered story that I've seen categorized several different ways, so it seemed like a good idea to ask Paul to be the one to describe it.
I'm sort of obnoxiously calling it my postmodern secular exorcism novel, and that's sort of the idea that I started with. It's funny, I have one of those rare, I feel like, you know, as a writer, you don't really have those eureka moments very often. At least I feel like I don't. But in February 2013, I was actually working on another novel. I was 100 pages into it. It was going to be sort of this, like, quirky comedy with the title of Charles Manson Doesn't Answer My Letters. yeah,
I love that title.
Yeah, you can't help but chuckle at it. But I sort of stalled and working on it for a while. But in my research, I stumbled across a book of essays on The Exorcist. It was put out by this specialty press called Centipede Press. They have a Studies in the Horror Film series, where, you know, they collect a bunch of essays and interviews for a bunch of different horror movies. Anyway, they published a volume on The Exorcist, and I sort of stumbled across and read it and found it just fascinating. You know, so many of the essays talk about the politics of the movie, you know, and the politics of the time, and there was an essay, and actually an investigative journalistic essay about the supposed, you know, true case which had inspired The Exorcist, which really turned out to be a bunch of bunk, not surprisingly. And, at that moment, I just started thinking, huh, there's really been, you know, there's been the literary update of The Zombie with Fulton Whitehead, Zone 1, I guess, being the most notable. The Werewolf, I feel like, has had some literary updates recently. You know, Vampire's still around. But no one's really done an update of or a response to The Exorcist, at least not in book form. Hollywood's been pumping out all these, like, PG-13 movies that, you know, teens and me go see on weekends. But no one's really, you know, written and tried to write another book about The Exorcist, at least none that I was aware of. So, yeah, that's where I started. So I wanted to approach it from, I guess, a skeptical angle, like a sort of a non-believer's angle, that, you know, approach it from a sort of a point of view where I don't really believe that, you know, someone is possessed or that this exorcism would actually work. That was sort of my starting point.
So the book focuses around a New England family, the Barretts, and the family member having the problem is a 14-year-old girl named Marjorie. Tell us what their situation is.
Yeah, so Marjorie is either, I mean, I guess try to make this as simplistic as possible. Marjorie is either suffering from schizophrenia or having some sort of psychotic break, or she's possessed. And I really tried to, you know, with all the other things that happen in the novel, I really wanted to try to keep that balancing act going throughout the entire novel. So the reader can actually simultaneously build a case that she actually is possessed, or the reader can build a case that, no, she's, you know, she's ill, she's schizophrenic. You know, I don't think I'm giving anything away, but I really don't come out and answer that question at any point in the novel. I feel like, you know, I hope the reader at the end will want to discuss and talk to other people. You know, what do they think? Do you think she's possessed? Do you think she was, or schizophrenic?
I read somewhere, and I can't remember where, I'm sorry to say, that it was a review about this book, and whoever wrote the review talked about how this was the scariest book that he or she has read in a really long time.
Yeah, I know. That was, you know, so many of the reviews have been very positive, and, you know, stuff like that. It's funny. When I sent the book to my agent, I was like, geez, is this scary enough? He said, oh, yeah. It's just too scary enough. I know, like someone who I've had like a lifelong love-hate relationship with horror. I think when horror is done well, I think nothing is better, at least in terms of addressing sort of, I don't know, to me the deeper, really the ultimate questions that all art tries to answer. You know, there's some sort of terrible truth that's revealed. Well, in a horror novel, it's usually a terrible truth, whether it be personal, societal, or universal. And to me, the best horror works after that truth is revealed. They then ask, you know, the questions that all literature asks, like, how are we going to live through this? What sort of decisions are you going to make? How does anybody live through this? Now, unfortunately, I think horror, more than any other genre, is sort of stereotyped and even represented by its worst works. And I think when you go to the average person and you mention horror, their eyes sort of glaze over and they imagine, you know, Friday the 13th or Freddy Krueger, or really sort of the schlock that Hollywood just produces. So that's what I mean sort of by my love-hate relationship with horror. So this book, to me, in a way, was sort of, I don't know, my lifelong PhD thesis on what I think a horror novel could and should be. And hopefully, you know, it works for readers.
So this is your what, your fifth novel, Paul?
Yeah, it is my fifth novel. Yeah, we're counting, I guess, I co-wrote a young adult novel with a friend under a pen name.
So is this similar to what you've written before? Are you a horror writer? Though I feel like I need to put horror in quotes now when I say that.
Right.
Are you a horror writer by trade?
Sure. I mean, I feel like that, I've been called many different types of writers. My first two novels featured a narcoleptic private detective. The first novel is called The Little Sleep. So when my first novel came out, I was being introduced as a crime writer. I don't know, it doesn't really matter to me. I do think that the theme that sort of ties together all my books is I'm certainly interested in the genre, whether it's the private detective or, you know, exorcism or horror novel, or, you know, I've written a science fiction dystopian. I think there's a law that every writer has to write a science fiction dystopian novel at some point in their lives. I like exploring genre and, you know, just trying to get under it, twist it around and see if I can find anything new, or at least new to me in it. So for now I'm happy to be called a horror writer.
Okay, fair enough. And now you live in Massachusetts. You're somewhere outside of Boston?
Yes, I do. I live in Stoughton, Massachusetts.
And so now, go ahead, I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, I grew up in Beverly, Massachusetts, where the book is set. So I've been sort of a hopeless parochial New Englander for most of my whole life.
And that was exactly the kind of question I was going to ask you. Has growing up in New England affected you as a writer?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I think it'd be hard to describe in what ways, but just having the opportunity to meet writers from different parts of the country. I mean, there's no doubt in my mind that, you know, the setting in which that you live certainly affects your work and affects your viewpoints. Even, you know, just something as simple as the weather, like living through, you know, the changes in the seasons, living through, you know, what can be really tough winters here, I certainly think, you know, affects your work. To me, like, it's most glaring and obvious to me when I have some friends who live in Los Angeles and write a lot about Los Angeles, and I don't know, they have just a different way about them, a way that I really enjoy being around. But I don't think I could write their Los Angeles novels today. I think I could only write, at least for now, the stories that I write that tend to be based in New England.
So when you tell people where you live and you talk about the types of books you write, does it inevitably lead to someone saying or asking, oh, were you influenced by Stephen King?
Well, usually I get that question more just for having written a horror novel. I think people always ask if you use sort of the first name that pops up. And for me, the answer is certainly yes. I feel like I've had a different road to becoming a writer than most. When I was, you know, a young boy and a teenager, I really wasn't like a big reader, unfortunately. I grew up wanting to be Larry Bird. And I spent my my hours outside in the backyard shooting free throws until it got dark. And I was a math major at Providence College, and I went to grad school and got my master's degree in mathematics. It was actually in graduate school where I fell in love with reading, and actually Stephen King was the first writer that I just read all the books that I could. My girlfriend, who's now my wife at the time, bought me The Stand for my birthday, and I read it and just loved it. And I spent 2 years in Vermont struggling to get my master's degree in math, and at the same time, I had fallen in love with reading. And when I got out of school, I got my first math teaching job. I know math, a true horror.
That's right.
Yeah, I just had this inexplicable urge to try to write a short story.
Hey, you must have a good left brain, right brain thing going on that you're able to both do math well and write well.
Well, thanks. Yeah, I guess so. I mean, I do think there's certain I don't get a fatigue factor that I think I would get if I was teaching English. I feel like, you know, if I was teaching students English all day and having to read essays and papers, I think that sort of part of me would certainly be tired by the end of the day. So it is nice to, you know, to talk about calculus and geometry, you know, when I come home, I'm not totally exhausted. I'm a little exhausted, but I'm not totally exhausted at the idea of having to sit down and write something.
So we need to start wrapping things up, but A Head Full of Ghosts, is it the type of book that is meant to purely entertain, or is there a message there that you want your readers to walk away with?
No, there's definitely, I mean, themes and messages. I think maybe the overarching theme is how, you know, I truly believe that even though, you know, I'm a skeptic at heart, I do feel like that, you know, reality is a lot more tenuous than what most people, what we live day to day thinking that, you know, what reality, we think reality is what it is. And, you know, in my book, you know, I put all these different sort of narrative layers in to sort of try to muddy the waters as to what's real and what's not real. And to me, that's where sort of horror lives, in that liminal space, space in between things. And I also think that the novel is certainly a feminist statement about horror itself. We chose to have, you know, the two sisters be the main characters, and have how, you know, women and young teenage girls in particular have been treated in horror movies and books, usually the movies, you know, for decades, and sort of have that be reflected in what's going on in the plot of the book as well.
And where can people find out more about you and interact with you and see where you're going to be next?
Sure. I guess my website is just paultrembley.net. I'm also on Twitter, Paul G. Trembley, or at Paul G. Trembley, and I'm happy to interact and have been interacting with people on Twitter. It's funny, I've been interacting with two screenwriters who are working on adapting the book for Focus Features, which has been kind of fun.
Hey, that's awesome.
Yeah, it got optioned by Focus Features and Robert Downey Jr.'s production company is attached to it. So, yeah, there's some very cool possibilities going on.
That is crazy exciting. Will Robert Downey Jr. be in it as well, do you think?
If it happens, they're sort of operating under the assumption that he would play a father, which is funny.
That's,
so like I said,
oh, my goodness.
No, very exciting. You know, hopefully it happens. I know right now they're working on the screenplay, so take it a step at a time.
A step at a time. Well, you know what? Let's send all good juju out there in the world that it happens, because that would be really exciting.
No, thank you. I really appreciate it. Yeah.
Well, thank you, Paul. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Absolutely. This was fun. Thank you.
Win a copy of A Head Full of Ghosts by sending a tweet to @LitNewEngland or an email to LitNewEngland@gmail.com. Do the same to win Erica Swiler's The Book of Speculation. A debut novel, The Book of Speculation, is a quirky, moving, and totally original family saga about books, magic, a circus mermaid, and a slowly crumbling house on Long Island Sound. Long before its June publication, the novel was listed on countless must-read summer book lists, including mine, Erica, who I think might be as original and compelling as her book, reacted to all the accolades the Book of Speculation has received at the start of our conversation.
Oh, well, it's all, I guess I'm in a state of shock because, you know, you write these things in your, you know, sort of solitary environment in your studio or your office or wherever. So it's odd to finally have a public reaction towards something that's been so private for so long. I feel very lucky that it's so good because it's an odd little book. It sort of skirts around genre in a lot of ways. And I was quite scared that people wouldn't know how to read it or what to make of it. So this has just been so exciting.
So can you, for those of us who aren't yet familiar with the Book of Speculation, can you tell us a little bit about what it's about and then what you were just talking about how it's, you know, not necessarily a straightforward read?
Sure. Let's see. The very short line that I like to tell people is that it's about a librarian versus his house versus the sea versus his sister versus a curse. So that's the straightforward plot line that way. But to be a little more clear, it's a family saga that spans about 250 years where a librarian winds up looking for his roots and finds them in this very old book about a traveling circus in around the late 1790s. And in this, he sort of finds the roots of this family curse, which drowns all of the women in his family on July 24th. So it's this very disturbing history, and he fears that his sister is about to fall victim to this curse, and he must find a way to stop it.
And for those who go to your website, mm-hmm. there is a countdown clock for
yes.
the day in 2015 that the curse will strike.
Right. I know everyone's website should have a death clock on it, shouldn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think it makes it a little more exciting. But yes, so this would be the date that, it's July 24th, where the women and the family typically drown. So if you are, strangely enough, if you bought the book on the day of release, you could actually read along with the timeline of the book specifically, day by day. The book does, in its contemporary chapters, it is a dual narrative, half in the past, half in the present. In its present-day chapters, it goes by date, counting down to July 24th, so you can follow along. And on July 24th, we are giving away the last of these crazy hand-bound manuscripts I made of the book. So, yeah, that's counting down to a giveaway also.
I didn't even realize that about the June 23rd and the countdown with the chapters and all. Did you plan it that way?
No, the release actually happened. It was just a coincidence. I said, oh, my gosh, well, that's kind of great. You can actually read, if you read it for the course of a month, you can read along at the pace of the book. But, yeah, that was just St. Martin's really wonderful sense of timing. But as far as going towards the date itself, I just wanted to have a very contained narrative in the contemporary period, because otherwise I'm talking about such a huge, huge span of time that it becomes hard to latch on to. So having this countdown throughout the book, I think, really just helps people stay grounded as far as where they are in the present day. So, yeah.
And now, are you going to go swimming on
of course
July 24th?
I am. Of course I am. I try and go swimming as much as possible because I am very fortunate in that I do live right by the Sound where this book takes place. So, I'm going to go swimming on July 24th and have myself a good old laugh, and hopefully nothing bad will happen to me.
Yeah, make sure you tweet yourself that night. So, you mentioned you grew up on Long Island Sound. The book is set on Long Island Sound. I, in Connecticut, look out onto Long Island Sound.
Oh, yeah.
And that was one of the first things I thought is, oh, my God, we're looking out on the same water.
Mm-hmm.
But
the beaches probably have some of our beaches. We've been sharing beaches for millennia now.
I know. I love that. So how much of the Book of Speculation is based on your life, Erica, and how much of it is fictitious?
Well, I always say everything everybody writes is based off their life, because that's what you have to draw on when you're making fiction. So even the most wild story is really just, it's pulled out of something in your head, someone you met, anything like that. But this area, the Long Island Sound, this north shore of Long Island, is very, very special to me. I think it's a really unique place, and it's gotten a terrible rap as far as, you know, Long Island in general and it, people's idea of what it is. But it's really, I think it's beautiful, and it's disappearing very quickly if you think about things in terms of climate change and sea level rise. So it was important to me that at some point in time I be able to write about this area because it is so special. And, you know, as a writer, it's such a gift to be able to grow up in a place like this that to not use it would be a crime. So that is, you know, the area itself is very, very heavily drawn from my life. And, you know, if you live in the Sound, you swim. So if there's a great thing to fictionalize, it's certainly swimming in the Sound. And everything else is just things I love, because why would you spend time, as much time as it takes to write a novel, if you're not writing about things that you love?
So how much time did it take you to write the Book of Speculation?
Oh, goodness. It took a very long time. I'd sort of, hard to count, because I did sort of desk draw it for a while, thinking I had no idea how to fix it. So it took years. It took a long time. And I first had the initial idea before I really knew how to write a novel. I was working in plays at the time. I just graduated theater school when the idea struck me. And I figured, oh, no, well, now I have to figure out how to write long form and not for the stage. And that took a bit. So it's an idea that's been with me for a number of years, but I needed the time to figure out how to put it down in long form in a way that was engaging and people could comprehend it, yeah.
So you use the word have that you said, I had, or had, rather. You said, I had to learn how to do this. Was writing a novel a necessity for you? Because it sounds like you could have just skipped the whole novel thing and, you know, kept on writing other things.
Sure. No, it was the first, I would say, big idea that I ever had. And I say it was a big idea because it felt very different from any other concept I ever had for working on a story or a play or anything like that. It just felt like a huge, huge world. And I heard this voice of this mute character, Amos, in my head. I know that's sort of odd to hear a voice of a mute character. And I said, oh, well, I have to figure that out. I have to. And then it just became an obsession. I think when you're writing books and you're doing something long form, you're not going to finish them unless at some point it becomes an obsession for you. So, yeah, it became a had to instead of just a, oh, wouldn't it be nice?
Oh, I love that. So your protagonist, Simon Watson, is a man.
Yes.
What made you choose to have a male protagonist rather than a female one?
That was just sort of the narrative voice to me that felt the most consistent. I had tried at one point to narrate from his sister Enola's perspective, and it was too, she's very high-strung, very flighty in a lot of ways, and it gave the narrative a rhythm that I wasn't really comfortable with. And it also seemed very important that I have a character who felt sort of isolated in a way. And when most people think of a librarian, they picture a woman.
Yes.
And there is this wonderful sort of odd creature that is the male librarian who's totally at home in books and just in this world that you think of as immediately being female. So I liked that sort of otherness to him in that sense. And other than that, I just thought there's a really interesting dynamic between sibling relationships, particularly brothers and sisters. So I wanted to explore that more. And just writing as Simon felt very natural to me. I really didn't think about his gender that much. I think more of character as opposed to gender. I think you write a person, you don't write their genitals, hopefully.
And now, really, the Book of Speculation is, in many senses, a creation of yours, because it just doesn't include your words as art. It also includes illustrations that you drew.
Yes, yes. Well, I thought the illustrations would be a good and interesting way to engage your reader a little bit more, because the book within a book, because it is a book that does contain a book, is illustrated and sketched all over to the point of almost being illegible. And I thought that it might be a really good way for a reader to connect, to see what the characters were actually seeing when they engaged with this book. So, yeah, the illustration sort of, and the in beginning, when I was initially submitting the manuscript, it became a way to sort of catch publishers' eyes and say, this is a special thing, this is very different. But then it just became such an ingrained part of the story itself. I have no idea why more novels for adults aren't illustrated. And I think it's just another level of communication with your reader that if you can have an illustrator, if you can illustrate, you should absolutely try it.
Well, you know, you said that it was a way to catch their eye because the illustrations made the book different.
Mm-hmm.
You could also argue, though, that different is risky, especially when you're a debut author.
Very. It's very risky. I mean, I'm sure, I think I made something like, I think I made 14 hand-down manuscripts were sent to different publishers, and I am absolutely positive that at least 10 of them are in the trash. You know, which is kind of silly because you spend all this time making these things and it's heartbreaking. But I'm sure it wound up on someone's desk and they thought, well, this is ridiculous and unprofessional. I don't want to look at this. But at the same point in time, it also caught the right person's eye and they fell in love with that object and the story and we made this amazing book together.
And it really is an amazing book. And you know what? I get the feeling that you're a pretty amazing person, too. I've been spending some time on your website where anyone who goes there to ericasweiler.com, you'll see this terrific picture of you wearing a hat in front of a stained glass window holding a bunny. And
yeah.
You let us know things like you're the whack-a-mole champion of the world.
Yeah.
And, you know, you have a baking blog, which is just hysterical.
Yeah,
and
you.
I just think that you are a one-of-a-kind person.
Thanks. I like to call myself a jack of all trades. I think my major love in life is learning to do new things, which is sort of counter to a lot of people that say you have to have this single focus to really succeed in a career. For me, it's sort of I want to learn everything and process it and figure out what I can make with it, what form of art that is, like if it is illustration or if it's going to be a novel or, you know, I happen to think of baking as art too. So I just want to, I enjoy picking things up and making them mine.
So now, do you write full-time, Erica?
I do now, which is kind of amazing. Yeah, I was really, really fortunate in that the circumstances around this book's publication have made it so I could finally leave my job as a legal transcriptionist. So, yeah, right now I'm writing full-time and working on Story of Those Days and another book.
That is really exciting. And can you tell us anything about the book, or is it a secret?
I can tell you some about the book. I'm going to try and not give away too much, but I'm working in 1986 Florida over the span of a week in January. And if you Google that carefully enough, you know what's going on. And it's around a little girl and her relationship with her father. And he's building a machine, and there are some very negative effects that this machine will have. So it's focusing largely on science, and time and how we perceive time. So nothing big, you know.
Okay. All right. I am going to have to Google that to try to figure
yeah.
that out. And Erica, we need to wrap things up, but the Book of Speculation, is there something that you want people to have felt or experienced when they close the book and are all done with it?
Sure. Well, I think for me, the line that keeps popping up that people keep saying back to me is that there are things that you do for people that you've known your whole life. And I think that this is really, it's a book about relationships, family, and love, and the different shapes that takes. And if you are still thinking about that after you close the book, then I won.
Erica, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Oh, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Tracy Slater is an integral part of Boston's writing scene as founder of the popular Four Stories literary series. Tracy is also the author of the memoir The Good Shufu, Finding Love, Self, and Home on the Far Side of the World. Set in both Boston and her new home, Japan, The Good Shufu is about travel and romance, but more importantly, it's a celebration of the life least expected. A life that is complicated, messy, overwhelming, and just totally enriching.
The Good Shufu is really about ending up in the life you least expected, and in many ways a life diametrically opposed to everything you had spent all your life before that planning for and working very hard to build. And the challenges, but also the real sort of gifts inherent in that, that, you know, sometimes you can actually end up in a life that fits you better and where you feel more rooted and have a stronger sense of self than you ever expected and you probably ever would have had you sort of gotten your way and had your firm plans worked out.
So you and your husband are two of the main characters in The Good Shufu. What's the story? Tell us about, you know, that big move you made, and what the heck is a shufu anyway?
A shufu means housewife in Japanese. In Japan, it has a slightly different connotation than in America. It's not, in some parts of America or in some communities or groups, housewife is seen as a somewhat derogatory term. In Japan, the term housewife or shufu has a much less derogatory cast. It's a very common term. Most women in Japan, or a high percentage of women, I'll say, even well-educated women, women who, you know, go to university, will quit their jobs once they marry, actually, even if they don't have children. It's not nearly as common in Japan as it is in America for women to be married and or have kids and work. So many women will identify themselves as a shufu. And it's the way that I am identified frequently in Japan on things like my gym membership and you know, other kind of documents that sort of give you a social title. And for many years in Japan, now I've been working as a freelance writer, and I was when I first got there, but there were a series of years there where I was barely working at all, and I was not contributing at all to the household income because of some medical issues that I went through that are detailed in the book. And so I was, for all intents and purposes, a shufu, not just sort of in title, but also, I really didn't have much of a career at all. And that is, besides Japan, that is a huge part of the life that I least expected. I was a fiercely independent academic in Boston, you know, who always thought I would have a thriving career and be supporting myself. And I never expected that I would call myself anything like a housewife. And yet the life that I fell into in Japan turned out to be a life, you know, filled with a kind of love and fascination and wonder that I think I never could have built for myself had I stayed in Boston, which is what I really, really had always wanted to do.
So when you moved to Japan, it was because you had fallen in love.
Yes, I did.
And you wanted to follow your future husband there. And clearly it sounds like this whole concept of shufu is something that took a little bit of getting used to, right? A whole change in mindset, which I'm guessing is a little bit easier said than done. But the whole lifestyle over there must be incredibly different.
It's really different. The lifestyle over there is different, and almost everything over there feels different. Except for the fact that it's a highly, highly advanced, technologically advanced and industrially advanced country. So it's definitely, it's in the Far East, but it's not in the West, but it's definitely the first world. So in that way, it's quite similar to life in America. But culturally, it also feels diametrically opposite to what I was used to, even down to little things like gestures. Not only could I not read or speak the language at all when I got there, but I couldn't even read the social cues. You know, even down to little things such as people don't say no very often in Japan. you're not. It's a culture that highly values consensus. So if you're disagreeing with someone, you just don't disagree in the way that you disagree in America. You say yes, but you say it in a different way, or you defer the question or something like that. And so just even on a very, very, mundane basis, I was totally a fish out of water. I had no idea. I couldn't read the social cues or the people at all.
So did you become a good shufu?
Well, the good part is definitely ironic. I'm a terrible housekeeper, and I'm not much of a better cook. But I am a woman who is very focused on my husband, and now I have a baby, a 16-month-old, and I have a much, much more of a kind of traditional nuclear family life than I ever thought I would. I'm financially dependent on my husband completely in Japan, and I'm dependent on him for very, again, mundane things such as going to the bank. I mean, I can go to the bank machine. The bank machine now actually has English on the screen. It didn't used to when I first got there. Our bank near our apartment didn't. I couldn't even go to the bank machine without him. But I never thought I would be the kind of woman who, when I needed money, I would ask my husband for money. But that's the kind of life that I have in Japan. And part of the reason that I think I can deal with it and what I write about in the book is because I still have my life in America, and I still have my American identity, and there's a way in which I think I compartmentalize, and, you know, I'm sure you could ask a shrink who may say, maybe that's not healthy or whatever, but it works. The kind of life that I live in Japan isn't profoundly, viscerally threatening to me because I still have my sort of other identity. And Japan is so foreign, it's so far away, and it's so foreign that there's a way in which it kind of enables that compartmentalization or makes it quite easy.
But you're physically in Japan the majority of every year.
Yes, especially
correct?
Now. When I first married my husband, or first, you know, knew that I was going to marry him, and in the beginning of the book, I'm actually living both in Boston and in Osaka on a shoestring, but because I taught at a university in Boston, I could teach one semester a year and then work as a freelance writer. I had the great privilege, which many people don't have, of being able to, you know, keep on working in the beginning and go back and forth for extended periods of time. Now that I have a child, and as when I was going through these medical issues before I had the child, which were involved in trying to have a child, I could not go back and forth. So about 4 or 5 years ago, I started living full time in Japan, which was a big adjustment for me psychologically, to, you know, not come back to Boston very often. But yes, I'm in Japan full time now.
But you're still very much connected to Boston because you are the creator and still involved in the Four Stories events.
Yeah, and I just did an online interview where I was sort of talking. Someone said to me, what is Four Stories, what has it given you? And it's just been so immensely rooting for me that I've been able to stay involved in the Boston literary community even when I'm in Japan.
And now how do you do that from thousands of miles away?
I have a great team of people who are running it for me. Sari Boren, Stephen Bieber, and Tim Huggins. Tim Huggins actually helped me start it, and Sari and Stephen recently came on. And I just announced at the last Four Stories event, which was the combination Four Stories and book launch party for my book, that I'm actually turning it over completely to Sari and Stephen, and I'll no longer be kind of involved in the sort of day, well, it's not really day-to-day operations because the events happen, you know, four times a year, but for all intents and purposes, I won't be involved in the, quote, daily operations anymore. Stephen and Sari are going to kind of take it and I think expand it in wonderful ways that I've been doing this for 10 years now, so my creative ideas are running down.
That's got to be very bittersweet, though, because it was a very tangible connection for you to have to the Boston literary scene.
Yeah, it was. I thought I had a little pang, you know, at the last event that, oh, my God, this is not going to be something that I'm so intimately involved in anymore. But I absolutely adore Sari and Stephen, and they're friends of mine, and they're also just people who I hugely respect as not just, you know, for their confidence in doing something like running a literary series, but they're just also really great writers and really great at staying connected to other writers And so I feel like, you know, they're kind of in my heart anyway, so they'll keep four stories in my heart.
So the Good Shoe Fu, can you tell us briefly how did it come to be? I mean, did you always think that you were going to write something about your new life in Japan?
No, I didn't actually. And one of the things I really struggled with when I got to Japan and when I started spending extended periods of time there and then started living there full time was, you know, I think it's very easy as an expat to sort of romanticize home and romanticize the life that you would be having at home. It's sort of the expat version of the grass is always greener on the other side. It's sort of like the grass is always greener on the side you left if you're an expat. And one of the things I really struggled with was all of these sort of, you know, grandiose images of all the things I would be doing if I was still living in Boston full time and all the ways my career would be expanding and all the great courses I'd be teaching. And I realized that that really wasn't getting me anywhere. And what I needed to do was, you know, make the life that I landed in the absolute best life possible. And it really wasn't too much of a stretch to realize that Japan was going to give me an incredible opportunity to write about. So when I first started spending time there, I didn't even have an interest in being there other than in Toru, my husband, with whom I was madly in love. But I had zero interest in living anywhere outside of Boston, let alone Japan, or in writing about it. But I started writing about my life there and found that I really liked it. And then I stopped when we were trying to have a child in my 40s and going through, you know, years of treatment in a country where I didn't speak the language and pregnancy losses and things like that. It was just too much to keep, you know, to be working or even to be, and particularly to be writing and sort of examining my life when I had no idea what I was doing or where I was going. So I stopped, and then I sat down one day a couple of months before my 45th birthday, about 9 months before my 45th birthday, and I wrote out a short piece that I sent to the New York Times Motherlode blog about why my husband and I had decided that we weren't going to adopt, even though my 45th birthday was coming up and statistically and medically I would have a 0% chance of conceiving at 45. And adoption is very, very rare in Japan, and it was sort of just about, you know, being in a multicultural marriage and kind of, realizing the ways in which a very foreign culture sort of matches and also doesn't match your own sort of feelings and desires about something so big as having a child. And I sent it off, and the KJ, the editor of Motherlode, very kindly, you know, was interested in publishing it. And the day or two after it came out, an editor at Putnam emailed me and said, would you consider submitting a memoir proposal? And it was like this, you know, incredible gift from God. I said, yeah, I will definitely consider that. And so I worked really hard on it, and it was a really fantastic thing to be able to focus on in the 9 months before I turned 45, and my husband and I were facing, you know, stopping all medical treatment. And the book was supposed to end with me, turning 45 and being in a very meaningful and yet, quote, barren marriage. Right as I was about to finish the manuscript, 4 months after, about 6 months after I had turned 45, I found out that I was pregnant naturally, and I had to change the ending of the memoir. So.
Well, isn't that the best reason to have to change the ending of a book?
It is the best reason. And I said to my editor, oh, my God, we were going to end it when I turned 45, so should I just end it and I'm not pregnant yet? And she said, no. She said, no. You can't show up to readings with a baby and have the book end that way. So the book ends when I'm still pregnant. You know, I didn't want to end it with, you know, especially with, the book is really not about infertility, but there is a chapter or two at the end where I'm struggling to try to have a baby and all the cultural issues with that in Japan. And I just didn't want to write a book where, you know, someone's struggling to have a baby in their 40s and then at the very end they give birth and it sort of all works out perfectly. I just, I'm not quite that optimistic. So anyway, the book ends when I'm pregnant, but I find out that the baby will be healthy and incredibly luckily she is healthy and wonderful. I gave birth 4 months after I turned 46.
That's fabulous. And I know we need to wrap things up, but, you know, you've gotten great reviews on The Good Shoe Fu. I love Joanna Rakoff's comment about how it reminds her of Eat, Pray, Love, rewritten by Woody Allen. And you were chosen as a Barnes & Noble Discover Great New Writers.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you. It was a huge honor and just such a pleasure to have that. Still kind of shocked about it.
What my last question to you is, what do you want people to have experienced or understood from reading The Good Shufu?
Well, I guess what I want people to experience first and foremost is to be able, hopefully I have been able to create a story that they get swept up in, because that's the thing I love most about reading, hands down, is getting swept up in another world. In terms of taking away from it or learning, I guess just what I learned that is reflected in the book is just that sometimes you can spend your entire life working really hard and planning really hard for one certain outcome or one type of life, and as life does, it throws you curveballs and you end up in the place you least expect it, and yet, you know, a lot of times that place that you end up is really the place that, you know, you sort of find a greater sense of self and a greater sense of home and love and roots, and there's something, you know, really wonderful and, as I said, kind of a gift in that. So,
Tracy, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Cindy.
I'm holding a copy of The Good Shufu in my hand that I would love to give away to you. Win it by sending a tweet to @LitNewEngland or an email to LitNewEngland@gmail.com, which are also the addresses you want to use to reach out to us to win Jennifer Zun's Mayumi and the Sea of Happiness. It's a novel that, like The Book of Speculation, is on so many summer reading lists. And it's also a novel that I loved, 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 loved. Mayumi and the Sea of Happiness is set on Martha's Vineyard, where Jennifer lives and wrote the book, and where I had the chance to interview Jennifer in person last month. For the interview, Jennifer and I sat on the porch of the West Tisbury Library on a fairly gray day with a breeze that, during the recording, you can just hear go by from time to time. Like its setting, Mayumi and the Sea of Happiness is gorgeous. It's a story about an affair between a middle-aged librarian and a 17-year-old boy. And at least for me, the experience of reading it was nothing but pleasure. Pleasure is also something protagonist Mayumi has decided she's long overdue to experience. And I had so many questions for Jennifer about the novel, including this. Because Jennifer is Asian and Mayumi is Japanese, did Jennifer's own heritage influence Mayumi's ethnicity?
I am Chinese German American. But I did my master's in Asian American Studies at UCLA, at the Asian American Studies Center. And so for those years, was in a very pan-Asian environment, which was really wonderful. So I got to learn a lot about various Asian American cultures. And it's funny, a lot of the information that I soaked up and filed it away, I didn't ever imagine that I would put it into a book. But there it went.
First of all, tell us about the story.
Well, technically speaking, it's about a middle-aged librarian who has an affair with a 17-year-old patron. I have been trying to think of a better way to sum that up, especially because people often ask me when I'm sitting at the library desk what my book is about. I thought of something yesterday. It's the story of an unadventurous, dissatisfied person who embarks on an unlikely adventure and finds bliss. Secret bliss, I should say.
And what is it that makes her decide to take this plunge? Because she takes a huge plunge, right? This middle-aged woman decides that she's going to have an affair with this 17-year-old kid.
Mm-hmm.
A very hunky man with a 17-year-old kid. But something had to, like, say, I'm going to do this. And I bet all of us, like, I know all of us have this desire inside of us to do something. But something holds us back. Something inside her said, I'm going to take this risk.
That is an excellent question. I'm not 100% sure why. But I do know that in the beginning, when she notices him, she never even entertains the possibility. Her interest in him is very sort of compartmentalized, apart from him as an actual person. It's just something that occurs in her mind. But then there's more than one incident in which she detects a hint of interest in her on his part, and that sort of activates in her a new feeling. For so long, she has just been isolated, not feeling noticed by anyone. Just, for lack of a better word, has her nose either buried in a book or is somewhere off with her young daughter. So she's not tuned in to the realm of her. She's estranged from her own desires at the point at which she meets him. And just that tiny, because he is also very shy and withdrawn. He doesn't come on strong, but there are just these ever so slight cues that she picks up on that I suppose you could say give her hope.
So even on the island of Martha's Vineyard, where the book is set, there are other ways that she could have taken a huge risk of some kind, right? She could have learned how to sailboard, or she could have learned how to scuba dive, or she could have learned how to speak the Wampanoag's native language, but instead she decided to have this torrid affair. Why the sex? Why is that what...
Do you mean why from my point of view, or why from her point of view?
Whichever way you want to answer.
I think it has to do with being in a situation where she's caught unawares. She is not seeking out an adventure. She has no desire to change her routine, to do anything differently. But a stranger enters her little world and turns everything upside down. I don't think if she were given a choice in advance, I don't think she would necessarily agree to it. So I think it was a physical, magnetic sort of thing.
So is there maybe an underlying message that if we keep our eyes open, then opportunity for something amazing might step right in front of us?
I like that, but I also think even if we don't keep our eyes open, that opportunities may arise. Because I don't think she was not the most receptive person, but somehow still, he reached her.
So this novel was published by Europa, which I think is the most...
Yay,
Europa, right? They're the most incredible publisher. Their books are just amazing. How did you feel when you found out this novel was being published by them?
I was thrilled. They have been one of my favorite publishers ever since Elena Ferrante. And yes. I used to push her on people back in 2006 when I first started working here, and her first couple of books came out. I was really in love with the short novels. I still am. But before the big buzz about her. So because of Elena Ferrante, though, I started paying more attention to that press. And then I read The Elegance of the Hedgehog, and I read Sarah Levine's Treasure Island with 3 exclamation marks. And I really love their books. So I couldn't be happier, and it's been great to work with them.
And your novel's gotten amazing reviews, and it's on all kinds of lists of books that you have to read for the summer. Yes, right? That's so exciting. Like, did you expect that kind of reaction? Did you have any idea when you were writing Naomi that it was going to get that kind of reaction?
Oh, no. Definitely not. I wrote this book to escape my first novel. And I think it was a sort of holiday for me. I wrote the book that I wanted to read. And I really wasn't even thinking. Well, because part of the reason I wrote it to escape the first one was because I still haven't finished the first one. And so all along there was a part of me that never believed that I would finish this one either. So I wasn't thinking that far ahead.
And you've been working on the first novel for how long?
I started it in 1998. But it has not been continuous. There have been events in my life that have taken me away from it. It's the imagined story of my father's life. And at a certain point, he fell ill, and then he passed away, and I just couldn't work on it for a long time surrounding that. And when I had a child, I also put everything in a box and put the box away. I was not one of those mothers who could just slip right back into working. I really didn't do any writing for at least a year, maybe two, after she was born. So, but then when I did have the chance, when she went to kindergarten, I took out the box and put all the pages out, and I just felt really overwhelmed. So I thought, I'm going to write something short. It's going to, 100 pages. I'll write a novella. It'll be 25 pages, 4 sections, 1 for each season. I finish it. And it ended up becoming longer, but I did finish it, and that was what I wanted to do. I was starting to feel like one of those people who doesn't finish what they set out to do, and it wasn't a good feeling.
Which is easy to do because writing is hard. Right? I mean, was there ever a time when you were writing this book that you were like, oh, I just don't know what to say next, or oh, I just can't finish this?
Not so much this one. Because writing can be easy. I think it's hard if you are really attached to writing a certain thing. Because my first book is so important to me. So many people would have abandoned it by now, but I, at least so far, am not willing to. And I think it felt easy for me to write Mayumi because it was just a less charged issue for me, if that makes any sense.
It makes total sense. And I had the pleasure of hearing you read on this past Friday night at Bunches of Grapes in Vineyard Haven. And one of the questions I had to ask you, and I'm going to ask you here again, is that you are a librarian. I venture to say that you're probably close to middle age, if not there. And your protagonist is a librarian. And there had to be some thought in your mind at some point during the process that, God, people might wonder if this is me, if I am Mayumi. And I'm just curious whether that was either a exciting and kind of titillating prospect for you or something that you were kind of afraid of.
It was not a titillating prospect for me, but it was something I thought of before I even started the book. There were so many things that inspired me to write the book, but one of them was living in this small town, loving the community after several years, it's been almost 9 years, feeling, just one day realizing, I really feel like I'm part of this community. I feel like people have accepted me. I feel like I belong. And then immediately having that panic sensation of, what would happen if I did something really wrong? And it would be so small, and I would be publicly humiliated, cast out. So I kind of went through the worst case scenario in my mind, and that's what got me wanting to write about it. And originally I was interested in, here's this moral dilemma, here are the consequences, and what is the town's reaction? That's what interested me at first. But to be honest, as I started writing, I let go of those original impulses. The ideas didn't interest me that much, in part because I became swept away by other things like desire and pleasure and time and memory, but also in part because I was talking to people as I was writing the book and realizing, oh my gosh, the people, I would have to do a lot worse for the people in this town to freak out. And I was really shocked, probably naively, by how many people are carrying their own secrets, and that just realizing this little town, this little island, is absorbing innumerable secrets on any given day. And it's part of living on an island. You learn something about someone, you file it away in some remote cabinet, and you don't think about it again because you have to share things and vice versa. So I started reading Mayumi last night. It's just beautiful. You can tell that you're a poet. The language is just beautiful. But I had a flashback to Friday night when you were talking about the process of getting it published, and you said something about how really there wasn't tons and tons of editing involved once Europa got their hands on it. And honestly, the first thing I thought was, that bitch, she writes this well on a first draft, or I'm sure, well, I know it's not a first draft of what you right. hand in, but it's what we read, if I'm understanding things right, is really very close to what you submitted.
Yes, but you're absolutely right. It was not my first draft. I wrote and rewrote and wrote and rewrote so many drafts.
Because it's amazing. The writing is really beautiful.
Thank you.
So I don't have to hate you. You didn't just sit down and do it like that.
No. Please don't hate me. Because I wrote and rewrote a lot.
So did your background as a poet, do you think it helped you at all in the writing of this novel?
I don't know if it helped me. It wasn't a good or a bad thing. It was just something that I brought to the project. It was my way of approaching the material. I am interested in language as a poet, and I can spend all day on what in the poetry world would be a poem. In the world of a novel is a sentence. So that's what really brought me back to the writing table were sentences and my love of sentences. And if I weren't a poet, I probably wouldn't have approached it that way. I would often just start with a sentence that I really liked and work on that for a long time. And I would just keep going back to that sentence. And then every once in a while, it would just lead to other sentences coming out. But really, it was a sentence by sentence, building it sentence by sentence.
So Mayumi is Japanese-American.
She has immigrated to this country, but she grew up in England, and she has an English mother and a Japanese father, who's an expat who also lives in England.
But she's an Asian woman who has an Asian name.
Yes.
Right? Which would lead some people to believe, when they saw the book, that it was a book about Asian people. Right? And if I'm not interested in the Asian American culture, that this might not be a book for me.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's important to note that it's not a book that should ever have that kind of label or limitations put on it. And I imagine you wouldn't want to have those labels or limitations put on it. But you made a conscious decision to have this certain character with this certain name.
I guess I have two things to say to that. In terms of making a conscious decision about the character, not exactly. I really never planned to have a woman with an English accent, or slight English accent, saying things to me. I really never thought I would write that character, and I never thought that I would choose to write about someone Japanese. If I was going to write about an Asian woman, I would think I would write about a Chinese American, what's closest to me. But that just sort of happened. The choice that was conscious was in the title, and there were people who warned me that by putting her name in the title, it was going to alienate readers, and I have been pleasantly surprised by how welcoming people have been, and people of all shades and colors have really loved the title, and it's one thing that even draws them to the book. So I'm glad that we kept it.
It's a fabulous title. It's a fabulous cover altogether of this woman in pink lying in this on her back, floating in this sea of happiness.
Yes, I love to, as you read the book, your relationship to the cover will change. And that's one of my favorite things about it. And the title.
And when did she start talking to you?
I don't remember exactly. It took me about 2.5 years to write.
But you mentioned a few minutes ago that you never expected to hear this
mm-hmm.
this woman with an English accent all of a sudden start talking to you. What, was there a moment that you first heard her voice?
I don't know.
So, you just had this event,
mm-hmm.
which was a pleasure to go to. Do you have any more events coming up?
The Martha Vineyard Book Festival is coming up, August
yes.
1st and 2nd.
Fabulous event.
And I get to be part of that.
That's really exciting.
And then at the Noepe Center, I'll be reading as well in Edgartown.
Nice.
I think it's August 27th.
Do you have a website that people can go to?
I do.
And what's the address?
It is, I have to say this, it's embarrassing to say, but it's jennifersun.weebly.com.
Okay. We can. You want to spell all that?
All of it?
All of it.
jennifersung.weebly.
That's one of the pains of radio.
Okay.
We must spell things. And it was either you or me, but I figured you would do it better than I would.
I think.
So we probably should wrap things up, even though I feel like I could sit here in this beautiful spot outside the library, despite the overcast weather. I could sit here forever. But why should someone pick up the book, do you think? Why should it be someone's next read?
That depends, of course, on the person. I would say it's at once a holiday. If you are in the mood for a vacation, read this book, but it's a vacation that you take without ceasing to think. It's a thinking person's vacation. How about that?
Okay, and even though it's on a lot of people's summer read lists, if you don't read it during the summertime, you can still read it very nicely in the fall and the winter, yes?
Oh, yes, because it is divided into 4 sections, 1 for each season.
Oh, perfect. That's right.
And if you want to know the truth, the hottest section is the winter section. It was a conscious choice.
The hottest section. Why did you do that?
Because I'm just in love with winter on this island. It's where so many secret, exciting things happen in the depths of the woods. So I really like that, and it's really true.
I love that. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
I just had the best time talking with Jennifer and all tonight's guests. If you haven't yet tried to win a copy of A Head Full of Ghosts, The Good Shufu, Mayumi and the Sea of Happiness, or The Book of Speculation, it's not too late. To be in the running for any of these titles, send a tweet to @LitNewEngland or an email to LitNewEngland@gmail.com. While you're doing that, let me send a big thank you to Paul Tremblay, Tracy Slater, Jennifer Zuhn, and Erica Swiler. Thanks to you as well for listening. The Literary New England Radio Show will be back next week with more author interviews and book giveaways, and I hope that you will be too. Until then, I wish you a great week and great reading.